Legislating is often a messy enterprise. Making the sausage always is. And that seems to be playing out today at the state capitol. The budget may be in trouble, but the governor's holding steady.
So I really believe this is the job that needs to be done, and this is the budget that I feel good about, and we're pushing forward, but I know that it's not going to please everyone.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, where we stand on a new spending plan. Also, one man tries to give a big tech's hold on his life, and another guy says it's not so tough.
And a really, really, really long-range photo of the Tempe skyline.
I am as interested in the social experiment of putting a camera out for that long a period of time as I am in the photograph that might result.
Plus, a tiny desert concert, and we soar above spring training.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Support for NPR comes from Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits succeed with email and online marketing tools, with coaches to provide guidance and help organizations meet their goals. More at ConstantContact.com. And from the sustaining members of KJZZ.
Good afternoon. Good Friday afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I am Mark Brody. Quickly to the Valley Roadways, I-10 westbound, there's a disabled vehicle at 24th Street causing a pretty good-sized backup. And on the 51 northbound, an accident on the exit ramp to the 101. Clear skies tonight, overnight lows in the mid-50s, sunny with highs of 80 both tomorrow and Sunday. It's 77 degrees right now.
The budget proposal hashed out by Governor Doug Ducey and GOP leaders in the state legislature remains a fluid situation this afternoon at the Capitol. The House and Senate Appropriations Committees both approved the package of bills yesterday, and leaders had planned to have the full chambers vote on the budget today or tomorrow. And while there appear to be bipartisan concerns about aspects of the spending plan, Ducey said this morning he feels good about the budget.
I ran on this budget. I talked about this budget in inauguration and State of the State. I stood with the Speaker and the President on January 16th. We're 7 weeks into this. Let's pass a budget. It's time to balance the budget.
Legislative leaders are still planning budget work today, but when that'll happen appears to be anyone's guess. Joining us now with the latest from the Capitol is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Hi, Howie.
Hi. Well, what the governor, of course, didn't say is, sure, he stood by the Senate President and the House Speaker, but does take more than that to actually get a budget out. Funny thing about that.
So what's actually going on today?
Well, essentially, the beatings will continue until morale improves. There are not yet 16 Republicans in the Senate or 31 Republicans in the House who are willing to line up behind this thing. So they're having what they call small group meetings. In other words, we take you in. We can either cajole you or say, what do you need? What changes do you need in the budget? Or what else can we do for you during the session? Or we threaten. Will that get the 16 and 31? Hard to say. I mean, eventually there will be a budget. Whether it's this budget, however, remains to be decided.
What issues seem to be some of the biggest sticking points among those members who are holding out?
Well, a lot of it revolves around the K-12 funding. Now, Ducey is saying that we're increasing K-12 funding by $102 million. Well, yes, but. And the but is that that includes student growth. In other words, more students should mean more money. The fact is that that includes at least a small part of the inflation funding that voters said that the schools should have. And by the thinking of the Democrats is when you factor those out, you're actually reducing funding. What's also true is no matter whose numbers you look at, if you look at per student funding, going back over the last dozen years or so, And you adjust for inflation, we're spending less per student there. That's a big problem. The governor's idea, well, I'm putting $134 million in a classroom. Well, yeah, but you're taking it out of their non-classroom budget, and then you're giving them less flexibility. And, of course, the $104 million he wants to take out of the universities is giving a lot of people heartburn because that's 14% of state aid.
How flexible do the governor and legislative leaders appear to be willing or able to be as far as trying to get some of the folks who have concerns on board?
Well, the question comes down to the second half of what you asked. How much are they able to do that? There's only a limited amount of money in the budget. They're not going to do any more borrowing. This isn't, you know, what Brewer did. There's not a new taxes coming. The legislative leaders rejected the governor's plan for a $7 surcharge on the vehicle license fee, which would have raised $30 million, which is about what they've added to university cuts. So what are we left with? You've got to make this thing balance, and there's only a few gimmicks in there. If you're going to take from one, you give to another. And this is going to come down to how do you squeeze the balloon.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks as always.
You're very welcome.
The requirement that Arizona high school students pass the AIMS test in order to graduate is going away next year. So what's next, and where does that leave students who haven't been able to make the grade yet? Dick Foreman is president and CEO of the Arizona Business and Education Coalition.
We do know that AIMS was a high-stakes test. It had a graduation requirement affiliated with passing that test, but that is going to end effective 2016. So those students that are required to pass AIMS will be required to pass AIMS, and they will do what students have always done, which is go back, study, retake, and pass.
From a standpoint of a business person, how important are standardized tests in terms of explaining to this state and the rest of the country that this is a place that believes in competitive education or is educating its students well?
Our kids deserve to be evaluated on the same level and in a peer group that allows them to compete with any other child from any other state. We want Arizona children to be able to go to the college of their choice, to be college and career ready, and for that, we need a rigorous assessment. The assessment itself, it is an Arizona assessment. It was set up by a committee of Arizonans, parents, charter schools, traditional public schools, superintendents, people that care about Arizona children. It is, in our opinion, the best assessment out there to prepare our kids for college and careers.
Where would we be without some sort of official assessment test?
You would be in a bit of a twilight zone. If you can imagine your son or daughter graduating from what you think is a school that you have trusted, and a school board and a district that you have trusted to establish a standard for graduation that is not recognized in 44 other states, and you go to apply because you think your son or daughter really did well, and you find out that instead of being provided opportunity for the tremendous amount of investment you've made in your son or daughter, all those years of homework and study, all those taxes paid, they are not welcome. It's unacceptable.
Dick, certainly for a time, there was funding set aside to help tutor those who had not done well on the AIMS test or help them get better prepared for the test. And we know that funding is tight at the state capitol. Is that something that's important, though, in order to have some of the students who maybe are not quite picking it up as quickly to help them get better? Should we have funding earmarked for that kind of thing?
Well, there's the multi-million-dollar question, right? The governor's budget that the legislative leadership has largely endorsed is a challenge for our public schools and for our public charter schools. The areas that are, if you will, under scrutiny would be guidance, would be counseling, would be librarians, would be classroom assistance programs that aren't under the Auditor General's report directly related to the classroom. But if I can use an analogy, there's an old story about an engineer being presented a glass that someone has filled it halfway up, and they ask the engineer, is the glass half full or half empty? And the engineer says, the problem is there's too much glass. I kind of look at the Auditor General's report the same way. We're asking you if it's half full or half empty, but he's not answering that question. He says you have too much glass. It is a meaningless observation when what we need to look at is resources. Without these resources, the question should be, can students achieve with librarians? Can students achieve with counseling, with guidance, with career guidance? Do students need ESL support? Do students need speech pathology? Do students have special needs? And should they be a part of the classroom experience, not considered administrative? Those are questions that the Auditor General should be asked.
Dick Foreman, President and CEO of the Arizona Business and Education Coalition.
A group calling itself the Maricopa Alliance for Shelter and Housing, or MASH, has outlined a series of demands for improvements at Central Arizona Shelter Services, or CAS. MASH wants changes made in the Men's Overflow Shelter and adjacent East Lot, and it wants some of them by Monday. Amy McMullen is a board member and clinic director for Phoenix Allies for Community Health and co-founder of MASH.
We have been working in close harmony with the Andre Hospitality House, which is an organization by the Central Arizona Shelter Service campus that provides hospitality services and food for the population who are centered around the shelter areas in downtown Phoenix.
And what led to the specific list of what you wanted CAS to implement in the Men's Overflow Shelter in the East Lot?
The people who work at Andre House every day help feed and service the population around CAS. And they noticed for a very long time that there's some very large problems with the overflow shelter and what is called the East Lot, which is right next to the overflow shelter for men's sheltering.
The overflow shelter will be closing soon. So why go after things that you want to have implemented that might just be there for a couple of weeks?
Well, we feel that every single day that people have to suffer through sleeping through an open parking lot in downtown Phoenix is one day too many. We made the decision quite a while ago that it's time for the director of CAS and certain state and local entities to take notice of the suffering that is going on down there.
You've talked about taking action if your demands aren't met by Monday evening. What kinds of actions might we be talking about?
Well, I think our demands are very simple. We're just asking that people who are sleeping in an outdoor parking lot have access to clean bathroom facilities, have access to clean drinking water, have the ability to wash their hands after using the bathroom, have the trash picked up on a regular basis, have the lot power washed. And there are literally people sleeping there who have mice and rats running over their bodies and into their sleeping bags at night. We believe that this is unacceptable.
But if things don't change, you talked about taking some kind of action. What might you do?
Well, we will probably arrange some kind of direct action in regards to a protest, start to make it so that the homeless population around CAS isn't so invisible. I believe that the reason that they are being ignored and their needs are being ignored is because they are literally out of sight and out of mind for most of the people in the city of Phoenix.
How much money do you think it would take to implement some or all of what you're asking for?
I really have no idea. My understanding is that there is money available out there in various coffers like HUD and other sources of revenue that are out there to provide housing and emergency shelter.
Do you think that what you're doing will sort of, if nothing else, raise the discussion about what's going on with homelessness in Maricopa County and what's going on at CAS and what's going on maybe at other facilities across the valley?
That is our hope. We really do want to bring attention to what is going on right in our backyard in downtown Phoenix. We just had a huge Super Bowl. There were millions and millions of dollars spent and people accommodated in all kinds of ways in downtown Phoenix, while right around the corner there were people shivering in the rain, soaking wet, sleeping on an asphalt parking lot at night.
In your mind, what's the best case scenario?
Our requests or demands are very simple. For one, we want the conditions immediately to be corrected at the parking lot. And then when they plan to close the overflow shelter on April 1st, we want them to have a plan in place as to where people are going to go.
Amy McMullen is co-founder of Maricopa Alliance for Shelter and Housing, otherwise known as MASH. Amy, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
McMullen, by the way, says she'll be at the East Lot on Monday evening to see if the improvements MASH is demanding are made. Mark Hollerin is the CEO of CAS.
Conceptually, I don't disagree at all. The overflow was intended to be a very temporary thing while the community discussed this broader plan of, well, how do we move people into housing more quickly and wrap the services around them? And that's sort of where we are at this point.
Do you intend to meet the demands? Are you able to meet the demands?
You know, we've had an opportunity to, you know, look at the items that were in the letter. You know, they said that the East Lot, the parking lot area, needs to be picked up. Well, that lot is swept every day, and we power wash the parking lot every Thursday. You know, from a pest control standpoint, inside the overflow shelter, we have pest control services provided biweekly. And they spray around the building, but you can't realistically control the pests in a parking lot. They brought up portable toilets, and there's a need for more portable toilets. In the parking lot, we have 9 portable toilets. The toilets are serviced 6 days a week. But I acknowledge that those toilets take a beating. I mean, these are things that are great challenges. The water amenities, you know, we're going to take a look at that. There was some issues as far as proximity of the water sources to the porta-johns. We're definitely going to take a look at that. You know, if additional resources can be identified, I think identifying other perhaps sites to have something like this, is a parking lot acceptable? No, it isn't.
I'm glad you brought up budget, because I'm curious how much of an issue money is as far as implementing some of these demands.
Well, if we added, I don't have the cost offhand, but, you know, for each porta john that we would add, there'd be more money for that, and that would have to be serviced. You know, we've tried putting garbage containers even outside the parking lot or around the general neighborhood, and, you know, most of those ended up being stolen. When we can't assure that these items will be used safely, then the vendors are very reluctant to work with us.
Do you have the money to do these things?
For the current operations of the overflow shelter, we have enough money to take these operations through mid to later May.
Conceptually, do you think the way that MASH has gone about this, bringing up some of its concerns and asking for change, is that, in your mind, the best way to go about doing what they're trying to do?
You know, I'm a pretty conservative person, so I don't opine on how people approach things. What I do like is the broader conversation that now is occurring about the overflow shelter and what alternatives do we have? What more humane alternatives should we be pursuing as a community? This is not a caste problem. Okay, we're not responsible for the homeless in Arizona. My take would be that the state, the county, and the city of Phoenix have that responsibility. We're an agency that tries to fulfill some of those needs. I think everyone needs to be open to input from all other sources, regardless of how it is delivered to us. But nonetheless, we should be listening, and not how they say it, but what they're saying. And I think some of the items that they brought up, that we're going to take a very serious look at to see, can we modify it? There's a lot of challenges here, and it sounds good, but I think it perhaps misdirects where the conversation needs to be, and that is, how are we going to resolve this problem? You know, this is going to require major surgery, and some of these things are more of a Band-Aid.
Mark Hollerin is Chief Executive Officer of Central Arizona Shelter Services, or CAS. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
The director of Maricopa County's Human Services Department says the sites have been talking but have not yet reached a resolution.
Coming up, why one tech lover is trying to move away from Apple, Google, and Microsoft.
If we need permission at some level to innovate and to publish, I think that's a really big problem.
That's ahead. It's the show. No surprise, on this early March day, we have sunny skies around the valley and warm temperatures. Look for lows tonight to be in the mid-50s, and then for this weekend, sunny skies with highs both Saturday and Sunday of 80 degrees. Currently, we have mostly clear skies and 79. Checking valley traffic, there's a disabled vehicle blocking the shoulder I-10 westbound at 24th Street. It had been causing a several-mile backup that has mostly been cleared. Also, we have a collision on the 51 northbound at the 101, that's on the off-ramp, and no stretches of heavy slowing to report at 221.
KJZZ is supported by Phoenix Union High School District, hosting a teacher career fair Saturday, March 7th at Metro Tech High School, 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. More information at phoenixunion.org.
The Phoenix Art Museum opened a new exhibit this week, and it's unlike most things you'd see in the museum.
This isn't your typical contemporary art show that's on stark white walls. We've used pinks and blues and yellows and purple walls because those are the colors he used.
That's Jerry Smith, curator of American and European art to 1950 and art of the American West at the Phoenix Art Museum. And the he to whom Smith referred is Andy Warhol. The exhibit is called Andy Warhol Portraits and includes more than 170 works by the pop artist.
They're of socialites, of politicians, of world leaders, of actors and actresses and singers and people that could afford to commission portraits and people that were in Interview magazine.
Do we learn anything either about Warhol or about the people that he's painting by looking at how they're represented on the canvas?
I think a lot of times you might be able to find it, but in many ways, since he is approaching portraiture different than artists, instead of examining the kind of inner psyche of the sitter, he's treating them more like they're a brand, almost like it's a Campbell soup can, but instead it's the person, it's the brand to stand in for the individual.
Well, so how does that manifest itself differently when you actually look at the portrait versus sort of a traditional portrait artist?
Well, you see that gloss. You see the idea of it being just surface, where he's using photography as his initial source and then making screen prints from that and then adding the bright colors and what have you. And yet there's great variety within the many different portraits.
Is this common for artists of his stature to basically take commissions for portraits like this?
No. he really, when you think about the time he is working in, first in the 60s, 70s, 80s, he's coming right behind the abstract expressionists, and they were not into portraiture at all. So he really brought back the society portrait through what he was doing. And if you were anybody, you were seeking Warhol to do your portrait at that time.
Can we take a look at a few?
Sure. Celebrities were notorious for wanting their portraits done for free. So you have Jane Fonda, who asked for hers to be free so she could sell copies to support Tom Hayden's run for state senate in the 1970s. Next to Dorothy Hamill here for part of a series on great athletes. But probably the biggest celebrity of the bunch might be Andy himself. And you see, you know, he became that celebrity amongst celebrities. And you see it in some of the self-portraits that we have, not only drawings from his early career and early days, but in large self-portrait we have here of his head with that fright wig, and it's 9 feet by 9 feet.
And he's blue.
And he's blue and just floating on this black, darkened background, like this kind of a mysterious icon, and it's just a wonderful image.
Did he typically take a photograph of the person that he was painting as opposed to having them sit there?
What he did initially, he used photo booth film strips, those 4 pictures, where people would order a commission, and he'd take them down to Times Square. And they'd sit in a photo booth, and he would just feed it quarters. And he'd be telling jokes as they're in there so they would relax and things. And from those, he would select a picture of the many that he took that he would then use to make the larger silk screen. And then later, he would use Polaroid films.
It seems like Andy Warhol is somebody who would probably have a lot of fun with the kind of technology, photographic, social media, that kind of stuff that's available now.
Oh, he would have eaten up what we're doing now with social media and selfies and that whole idea. I really firmly believe that if he were around today, we probably wouldn't even be calling them selfies. We'd be calling these photographs Andy's. You know, he was that attuned to the idea. And that's why his art matters. I mean, when you think about the idea of all of the artists who have ever lived, think of famous quotes that artists have said. That one of, in the future, everyone will be famous, world famous, for 15 minutes. Everybody knows who said that. And that's because it speaks to our time today.
Jerry Smith is curator of American and European Art to 1950 and Art of the American West at the Phoenix Art Museum. The exhibit, Andy Warhol Portraits, will be on display through June 21st.
Most of us have our technological lives dominated by the usual big corporate names like Apple and Microsoft, and it may seem pretty daunting to leave those behind. But Dan Gilmore, professor of practice at ASU's Cronkite School and former tech reporter for the San Jose Mercury News, is giving it a try. He wrote about it in a recent essay called Why I'm Saying Goodbye to Apple, Google, and Microsoft.
The promise of the internet was a radically and massively decentralized network of networks where a lot of innovation and conversation and all kinds of things would go on out at the edges of the networks. what's happening in recent years is that the technology and communications systems that we use are becoming, to a large degree, re-centralized, so that a few very powerful entities at the center are exerting more and more control through what amount to choke points.
Is that dangerous in very solid ways, or is it just dangerous in the concept that we know that our privacy is already limited and this will just limit it more?
Well, it's about much more than privacy. Privacy is a big, big part of it, but I use the word control quite deliberately. If we're not in control of the tools that we use, of the communications tools and computing tools, we've given up a lot, including privacy. That's really an offshoot of the larger problem. If we need permission at some level to innovate and to publish, I think that's a really big problem.
I want to go specifically to Apple, because you write in the essay that I've referenced, at Silicon Valley events early to mid-2000s, you would be one of just a couple of journalists with Mac laptops. That's sort of reversed now. Your feelings about Apple, what changed that?
I was absolutely a fan of Apple for a long time. I was very much, and remain very much, impressed with what they do in the way of building technology that combines hardware and software in quite elegant and useful ways. They're brilliant at that. What I don't care for about Apple is the degree to which they've become control freaks about how their users can, their customers can use the stuff, how software developers have to do things their way or the highway, as the saying goes.
Do you feel like if people make the conscious decision to do what you're trying to do, that it is easier than people might think when they initially hear, wait a second, I can't use Apple, I can't use this or that?
It's hard for me to know the answer to that, because I've been using technology for so long, and I'm not bothered by doing a bit of work with things like Linux and other systems. But it's certainly possible to buy computers with non-Windows, non-Apple operating systems, and it's certainly possible to get a mobile phone or tablet to work with an operating system that's less controlled. It's certainly possible to use Facebook less and other things more. Again, I think it would be absurd for me to say to people, I want you to go cold turkey on all of this stuff, because I haven't done that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm in New York, and I'm using Google Maps. Mm. So, you know, to some extent, let's put it this way, there are a lot of ironies bordering on hypocrisies in my own practices.
Dan Gilmore is professor of practice at the Walter Cronkite School at ASU. His piece we've been talking about is called Why I'm Saying Goodbye to Apple, Google, and Microsoft. Dan, thank you for squeezing us in from New York.
Glad to be with you.
There are groups of people who've already pushed themselves away from many of the huge tech names and have focused on the free software movement. Hans Kugler, chairman of the Phoenix Linux Users Group, is one of them. Hans, you're wearing a T-shirt that says Free Software, Free Society. What kind of impact is free software having?
Most of the technology we have today is based on free software. Google wouldn't exist without free software. A lot of other tools, big companies that we think about, social media that we have, is all based on free software tools. And most of them are actually releasing free software tools out into the wild. It also gives us better accountability. So I can go look at the source code for the tools I'm using. I'm not really qualified to do a security audit, but I can get somebody who is. And we have thousands of people around the world who are qualified, who are looking at security implications. If I have software for creating a website, I can create whatever kind of website I like. Not just what the guys that wrote it, the people who wrote it, might not agree with my website. Too bad. I'm allowed to use it.
Do they perhaps not even realize at times they're using free software?
If you're using an Android phone, Android is based on the Linux kernel and is based on free software. It's not completely free software. There's some things that Google has. And also, anytime you get the FCC involved, certain you're familiar, there's regulations and things that come in place. But it's mostly free software. And in fact, there are free software forks of that where they're completely free software. I believe they're completely free software without the proprietary pieces. And the nice thing about that is it gives us normal people access. A friend of mine, a former student, was a mechanic, car mechanic. Mm-hmm. He found out he could change the software in his phone, and it completely opened up a new world for him. But he also went through and created a fork of the Android operating system that they're now helping to port to phones that didn't come with Android.
So all right, let's say the average person who's listening right now is not someone who uses a lot of technology, mm-hmm. uses the standard stuff, in fact, may just be someone who wants to surf the web. Mm-hmm. If this person says, I don't want to use Google, I don't want to use Yahoo, whatever it may be, mm-hmm. but they want to use a Linux-based system. Can you walk us through that? Is there any, what's the difference?
Web browsing is a standards-based system that grew up around free software. So we created it. We have moved it forward. And certainly there have been companies like Google, like Yahoo, that have moved the technology forward as well, but always around a base of free software in the end. Mm. So yes, we can do those. That person can buy a computer that already has Linux installed, and then it's already there.
Hans Kugler is chairman of the Phoenix Linux Users Group.
Still to come, a local band with an eerily interesting sound.
It reminds them of being abandoned on the side of a road in a swamp with no cell phone or no weapons.
A tiny desert concert with the Numbats. That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody along with Steve Goldstein. On Valley Freeway's I-10 westbound, there's a disabled vehicle at 24th Street blocking the shoulder. Also an accident on the 51 northbound on the exit ramp to the 101. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. We're looking for a high of 80 degrees. Clear skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows in the mid-50s. A sunny weekend as well through the beginning of next week. Look for a high tomorrow of 80, more of the same on Sunday. Sunny skies right now over Phoenix, 79 degrees at KJZZ at 235.
KJZZ is supported by Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts. The dancer illusionist of Momix perform Alchemia, a new multimedia spectacle inspired by the four elements, March 20th and 21st, scottsdaleperformingarts.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. Justice Department sources tell NPR News that officials are preparing corruption charges against Senator Robert Menendez. They are expected to allege that the New Jersey Democrat used his office to help a donor's business in exchange for gifts. A Menendez spokesman says all of his actions have been lawful. The Federal Reserve has held short-term interest rates near zero for more than 6 years. But Steve Beckner of Market News International reports today's strong February report, 295,000 jobs created, 5.5% unemployment, could soon mean higher rates.
When she testified before Congress last week, Chair Janet Yellen said the Fed would raise rates if labor markets keep improving and it becomes reasonably confident inflation will rise to 2%. The latest employment report, which showed a 0.2 drop in unemployment to 5.5% and a surprisingly large rise in non-farm payrolls, seems to fit the bill on jobs. The remaining concern now is below target inflation. But San Francisco Fed President John Williams, a key voice, has said he is quite confident inflation is headed higher and said mid-year rate hikes should be seriously considered. Fed policymakers meet in 2 weeks. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
A Palestinian driver in Jerusalem hit and injured 5 Israeli pedestrians today. Israeli police are calling it terrorism. NPR's Emily Harris reports it's the first such incident since late last year.
Late last fall, there were several incidents like this all around the same time and all along the same big main street. Several people were killed and quite a few injured. At that time, tensions were also high over limited Muslim access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque or the Temple Mount, the site holy to both Muslims and Jews in Jerusalem's Old City.
On Wall Street, the Dow closed down 278 at 17,856. This is NPR.
The Tempe skyline isn't typically one that would blow you away. It's not on par with Chicago or New York City or any number of other smaller communities. But this is the place where experimental philosopher Jonathan Keats has decided to place his Millennium Camera, which hopes to document 1,000 years of change in Tempe. He and I met where the camera has been placed on the third floor of the ASU Art Museum.
why not do 1,000? And so the Emerge Festival organizers at Center for Science and the Imagination were good enough to get in touch with the museum, and the museum was crazy enough to say that they would give me a little bit of space, 1,000 years of time, and they would even put in a session number for the year 3015 on the photograph that would result from this 100-year, or rather from this 1,000-year exposure.
1,000 years, how do we have any idea what's going to be here in 1,000 years? But maybe that's part of the point.
Absolutely. I am as interested in the social experiment of putting a camera out for that long a period of time as I am in the photograph that might result. This is a photograph that is certainly meant for people 1,000 years from now to be able to see, and the museum has committed to an exhibition in the year 3015 so that people will be able to come to the museum and see it. But it is as much really for us here today and for everyone in the long span between now and then.
When you think about this particular place, does this excite you, the actual place, or is this really more about the people that will get a chance to see it and learn from it?
In the case of Tempe, we have an urban phenomenon that I think is a very important one in the near and in the long future. Essentially, the way in which suburbia gets incorporated into this urban organism, and where urbanism is probably the most important consideration right now in terms of long-term sustainability of society. Because this does seem to be a model that we're seeing more and more of around the world, Tempe is a perfect case history for what that might be, and also is a perfect opportunity to see what we can make of that approach to making a city, to making a viable place.
Let's go over and take a look at what you've done here. Can you describe it?
The 1,000-year camera is my attempt at reading and reverse engineering archaeology and a little bit of art conservation as well. The real reason for making it in this shape and in this size is that a smaller object is less likely to break in one way or another, and making it out of a single metal, out of copper, making the casing out of copper, a metal that we know very well the behavior because it's been around for a really long time, that as a result, we can predict how the camera as an object will last through time. And what will happen is that it will take on a patina. The patina will protect it against the elements to a certain extent. So the camera works by letting in light that is focused through a pinhole. And because it is a pinhole, the amount of light let through is very little. The light is projected onto the emulsion. What I've done is to use an oil paint for the emulsion that is going to fade very slowly. I can make some sort of a prediction of how the emulsion will survive through time, and also some sort of prediction about how the light passing through that pinhole will affect it as it bleaches and we end up ultimately with a red and white photograph. My photographic process is a very different sort of thing. Fading as opposed to using the traditional photographic processes or using some sort of a digital process, we will end up with a photograph that won't be very stable, which is to say that if you leave it out for 100 or 500 years after the 1,000-year exposure is done, it's likely to fade away completely. So conservators of the year 3015, please take note. I think, however, that there will be a span of time where it can be looked at and where people can make a record of it should they so choose.
Experimental philosopher Jonathan Keats getting us ready for 3015 with his Millennium camera.
There are plenty of libraries, monuments, and streets named after historical and political figures. In Arizona, we even named a train after one of them. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us more.
Before the light rail was developed, there was another public rail line. It was created as a temporary form of transportation during the Great Valley Flood more than 30 years ago. Did you know the temporary rail line was named after Arizona's First Lady, Harriet Babbitt?
At the time, the governor was Bruce Babbitt and his wife was Hattie.
Rob Bohannon has been in the railway industry for years and was among a group of people who worked during the flood.
So the train was named the Hattie B to kind of honor the governor's wife and to honor the fact that the governor's office had to get involved in order to make it all happen.
Bohannon says in February 1980, there were a series of storms that washed out several bridges over the Salt River, from Mesa to Buckeye. Remaining bridges were questionable. Engineers were so alarmed, they decided to close most of the bridges over the river, including the I-10 crossing. Central Avenue Bridge and the Mill Avenue Bridge at the time were the only two crossing points in the valley. As we stand at Tempe Beach Park, Bohannon recalls the flood.
Traffic was a nightmare because the valley was divided in half.
So ADOT, Amtrak, which still operated through Phoenix at the time, and the Southern Pacific Transportation Company, which operated the track, joined forces and developed a public rail transportation line. For 2 weeks, the Hattie B traveled from downtown Mesa over what is now Tempe Town Lake to Union Station in downtown Phoenix.
The trains were all packed, and it seems to me it made 6 or 7 round trips a day, and they had 5 coaches and a locomotive at each end.
Bohannon says he rode the train. He says although the coaches seated about 70 people, they were standing room only. Bohannon says the temporary public rail line proved to be an asset.
The reality is the Hattie B paid for itself, even though there weren't any tickets sold, because it kept the economy going in the valley.
So how did Harriet Babbitt feel about a train line being named after her?
Oh, I loved the idea. It filled a hugely important need.
That's the former First Lady, and she remembers another name the train was given.
I mean, it was so used so much that it became known as the Sardine Express, because it was... the cars were absolutely packed with people who otherwise would have spent, you know, 8 or 10 hours in traffic.
Bohannon and Babbitt believe the Hattie B helped the valley imagine a public train line for the future. Oh, Hattie Babbitt says she still has a T-shirt commemorating the rail line, the Sardine Express. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
And if you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique or know something that we should know, tell us about it. The show at KJZZ.org. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ with Steve. I'm Mark. The show is a KJZZ original production, mixing news and features from the Valley, the region, along with national and international news to provide a stream of engaging radio.
The Numbats are a local three-piece band, and its members describe their music as a 90s revival. It's a fitting description that you can also hear lots of different influences in their songs, including grunge, surf, pop, and even 70s punk, with an added grittiness and resilience reflective of the desert. We invited the three women to make up the Numbats, Emily Hoba-Hadar, Sobe Opich, and Mo Newharth, to KJZZ for a tiny desert concert and a conversation about their music. They started things off with the song, I Want You.
Yeah, I want you.
someone wrote a review about us saying that when they listen to our songs, it reminds them of being abandoned on the side of a road in a swamp with no cell phone or no weapons in the complete darkness.
That's not...
No weapons. That's interesting. Addition in there.
I think what she was trying to say is that it's intense.
Yeah. Mo, how has the music evolved as the band has changed?
I definitely think we started off a lot less complex. I hadn't started playing the drums. I started when we started this project. So, I mean, just technicality and musicianship has obviously evolved for the better.
Yeah. Sophie, what about lyrics? How important are lyrics to you? Because there are a lot of people who pick up, they come to love a singer or a band or a group because of lyrics, and others just love how it sounds.
Oh,
so
definitely.
At this point, how important are lyrics?
Oh, I think they're important.
She's Emily, a poet.
Emily and I are both poets. Everyone's a poet.
I'm not a poet.
I think when I listen to music, I like a song to be fulfilling on all levels. I like when the lyrics are cool, when the music is cool, when the beat is cool. And so I think it's equally important for us. We don't take it too seriously, but it's cool having three heads when we approach lyric writing.
I don't know. I'm a big fan of when lyrics are not so mysterious and they're just straightforward.
Yeah.
And they pretty much, you listen to it and you know what they're talking about. And I feel like you can connect easier to a song like that.
And mood has so much to do with kind of when you write the lyrics, what sort of mood people are in. And for me, I mean, having lived here as long as I have a totally different mood when it's sunny as opposed to when it's overcast. And
yep.
Does that affect you guys when you're playing your music or getting ready to come up with a song?
Well, it's funny because most of our songs were written during summertime. So,
but that's because you just stay inside, you know, and you just lock yourself up in the house. And
hope the air conditioning works, yeah.
Yeah, and our practice space in the summer is pretty brutal.
It's in a basement, cement walls, and
it's hot. There's
okay,
no
so you,
ventilation.
So you guys have no, okay. Not even a ceiling fan or something like that.
Oh, no.
I have wow. a little tiny fan that is called a Vornado.
But it just hits one person. It doesn't
We trade off.
So how long can you stay down in that space?
A long time.
Yeah, we've stayed down there for
a whole day.
Yeah.
We recorded our album down there, actually. And
in
that
summer.
Was, yeah, in the middle of summer. It was maybe July was when we did it. And we chugged through it. Water bottles, tank tops, popsicles.
Yep.
Well, I wonder, I'm still into that creative process. How do you think that affects what the final product was then? I mean, as my brain gets older, which it's getting very old, you know, I wake up in the morning, there'll be a song in my head that I don't think I've heard for weeks, and it might even influence the way I go about the rest of the day.
I remember this summer when we were recording our album, Emily was listening to a lot of kind of like 90s grunge, you know, like Pixies and Nirvana, and I was listening to like the Beach Boys, and so I'm wanting to do all these, you know, like pretty vocal harmonies, and we're practicing harmonizing, we're really practicing the vocals, and then she's wanting to just make it just really grungy. So then those things come together, and I don't know, it's cool.
That's Mo Newharth, Sophie Opich, and Emily Hobahadar of the Numbats playing their song The Other Angry Woman. They're playing tomorrow night at Time Out Lounge in Tempe. If you're in a band and would like to play a Tiny Desert concert, send us an email, theshow@kjzz.org.
It's a bird. It's a plane. No, wait. It's a dirigible.
That's right, Mark. The DirecTV blimp is in town, and this man is at the helm.
Brett Veets. I'm the acting chief pilot on the DirecTV blimp.
Veets and other crew members are in town for spring training. The giant blue blimp with a 70-foot TV screen is tethered to a tall pole called the mast.
It takes about 10 people on the ground to launch the airship, and then it takes that many to land it. All set, seatbelt on.
Airships hop from event to event all over the U.S. You may have even seen one of the MetLife blimps during the Super Bowl.
Yeah, and it's kind of a big deal because Veet says there are only about 6 airships flying in the U.S. right now.
It's unique, so people notice it. You know, there's so many different things out there, but just so few airships that it's always going to get noticed.
Veet says he's one of about 30 active airship pilots in the country, which means a lot of travel time.
With our company, it's 330 days a year that you're on the road, 330 nights a year in hotels.
And hundreds of hours gliding over the country at a steady 35 miles an hour.
The crew from Van Wagner Airship Group is in Phoenix to film the spring training games.
Basically, it's the same type of camera that you would find on a television news helicopter.
If you see dazzling aerial shots while watching a Cactus League game, it might be from the blimp, but so are some of the close-ups.
Yeah, that camera zooms in great. Once in a while, you know, at football games and things, they'll do the instant replays off the airship shots.
So the next time you watch a major sporting event, you might get to enjoy the same view as Veet's. Or you can go to KJZZ.org and check out the video of our ride-along. Spring training baseball has started, and the Arizona Office of Tourism wants visitors in town for games to explore more of the state. That's part of an electronic billboard campaign that shows images of some of the state's iconic places, with the website springtraining.com conspicuously displayed along the bottom. Sherry Henry, director of the Arizona Office of Tourism, says it's a two-phase strategy.
The first phase is sort of that pre-planning, you know, when the consumers are planning their trips. And now, of course, we're in the second phase, which is what we call in-market, which encourages day trips by providing content for restaurants, hotels, attractions, things to do, itineraries, because we want the fans to enjoy the spring training, but we would also like to encourage them to see more of Arizona.
Henry says the goal is to get tourists who are coming specifically to enjoy games to stick around for even one extra day.
What can you do in that one extra day? Well, in one extra day, you can go to southern Arizona for the day. You can even make it down to Mexico. You can go to Sedona. You can go up to Flagstaff. You can do all of that comfortably in one day. You can actually do the Grand Canyon in one day if you get up really early.
Henry says 1.7 million people attended spring training games in Arizona in 2014, and if the weather cooperates, that number is expected to grow this year.
Mark and I are big baseball fans. You might even say we're fanatics. So when pitchers and catchers report and spring training gets underway, it's a time of the year we like to think about.
Yeah, you know, growing up in southern New England, there were two major league teams within a short drive, three if you count the Mets. Every year come February, I'd burrow a tunnel through the snow to get to the newspaper box so I could read about all things Yankees in sunny Florida. There's never any real jealousy about my baseball heroes practicing among the palm trees while I was putting on my eighth layer of clothes to go out and shovel. That's because no matter how cold it got and how many times I slipped on the ice, I knew that baseball, and by extension summer, would be here soon enough. I was never able to get to a spring training game until I moved to Arizona more than a decade ago. When I was growing up, the games weren't even broadcast, and this was more than a few years before live streaming would become a thing anyone had heard of. But I imagine the players, having escaped the northeastern winter, basking in the warm sun of Florida and Arizona, playing catch and taking batting practice. And I dreamed about the day when the snow would melt and my next-door neighbor and I could bundle up, dig out our wiffle ball bats, and renew our version of the Yankees-Red Sox rivalry. When I finally got to a spring training game, it was fun. A relaxed atmosphere, beautiful weather, and lots of excitement. But it also felt a little like a regular season game, just with players I'd never heard of. I recognize the reality probably never matched my frostbitten fantasy, but frankly, I'm just happy people are playing baseball.
For me, growing up in Phoenix as a baseball fan, once the regular season started in April, the closest I'd get to a Major League Baseball game was through my radio, with Vin Scully doing Dodgers play-by-play. And the Dodgers were the despised rivals of my favorite team, the Cincinnati Reds. So in mid-February arrived and brought some of the best baseball players in the world to my hometown. Whether the games counted or not, I was ecstatic. That spring sensory explosion poets often write about may sound too ridiculous to be real, but it was an actual collection of feelings I had, and most of them revolved around spring training. The smell of a freshly mowed outfield, the sounds of a pitch popping the catcher's mitt, and the taste of an overcooked hot dog with just a little bit of mustard in a soft, squishy bun. In those early to mid-80s days, I'm talking about the year and the temperature, we could get autographs and the players never seemed wary or to think that we only wanted to sell them. Usually we didn't even know who the players were because they were wearing uniform numbers between 70 and 90 and probably wouldn't even go north with the big league team. The innocence of those days really hit me when I looked into buying tickets last spring. If I wanted to be in a real seat and not on a towel, I'd be paying at least $20 because, yes, spring training is now big business with top-notch stadiums that need to be paid for. I understand all of that. I also understand how much fun it was to arrive at a game in the fifth inning and have a security guard let you in for free.
Well, if you'd like to head out to the ballpark, plenty of Cactus League games going on this weekend. Also, you can check out the Arizona Aloha Festival this weekend at Tempe Beach Park.
Edgar Winter Band, Mark, that's the guy with the long white hair.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He's playing Saturday night at 8 at the Lounge at Harrah's Auction Casino.
A guy who does not have long white hair, Jerry Seinfeld. He will be at Comerica Theater in Phoenix tonight. Who are all these people?
The annual Run for Ryan House takes place tomorrow morning from 7 until noon. That's at Market Street at DC Ranch in Scottsdale.
Also, the Baseball City Experience is this weekend at Scottsdale Civic Center, sort of a celebration of spring training in the Cactus League.
And Mark, if you love T.S. Eliot and Broadway musicals, and I know you do.
Of course.
You can go see Cats. That's tonight, Saturday, and Sunday at the Musical Theater of Anthem.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer and Maria Springs are our digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban.
We want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. We are at the show at kjzz.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. All Things Considered is next on listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. Hope you have a great rest of the afternoon and a great weekend. It's 3 o'clock.